I think that as a founding story, Jamestown is important, not only because Jamestown was the first successful English colony. All successful English colonies after followed, if you like, in the wake of Jamestown.
Good morning. I have a couple of preliminary announcements before we start this forum. I'm delighted this morning to be able to introduce a new assistant to the forum program. On my left, your right, is Dr. Cristina Lopez-Gottardi. Dr. Lopez-Gottardi grew up in Miami. She was educated at Middlebury College, where she studied political science and Spanish. And she earned her PhD in international relations at the School of International Studies at the University of Miami. Her thesis examined the growth of opposition in Cuba, problems and prospects for democratization. Easy for me to say. Most recently, she was on the faculty at Emory University, where she edited the Institute for Comparative and International Studies newsletter and ran major institute programs, all experiences that give her rich preparation for work at the Miller Center. She moved to Charlottesville last summer with her daughter Carolina and her husband Raul Chow, who holds a tenure track position on the Darden Graduate School of Business Administration faculty. Cristina Lopez-Gottardi's appointment will enable me to devote more time to my other principal responsibility here, the National Discussion and Debate Series. Cristina is already helping me plan events for later this spring and for the upcoming academic year, and she will assume an increasingly visible role over the next few months. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Cristina Lopez-Gottardi. This is the second annual Mary Beth and Gordon Smith Lecture on American History. For those of you who know the Miller Center and have been coming here, you may have encountered Mary Beth and Gordon Smith, who are seated here in the front. Gordon is a retired business executive who has engaged, he and Mary Beth have engaged in extraordinary philanthropy in the local community. They lived for many years in Nelson County before moving here to Charlottesville. And while in Nelson County, they learned that there were a number of very able kids who were getting ready to graduate from high school for whom college was financially an impossibility. They stepped forward and through their personal philanthropy have provided the means for roughly 50 young men and women from Nelson County to get a college education. They have been regular and important friends of the Miller Centers, and we are indebted to them and grateful to them for their extraordinary philanthropy, which enables us every year to have a forum on an important topic in American history. So this is the second annual Mary Beth and Gordon Smith Lecture on American History. Please help me to thank the Smiths. Today we welcome back to Charlottesville and to the University of Virginia the distinguished scholar and vice president of research at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, Dr. James Horn. Dr. Horn was educated at the University of Warwick and at the University of Sussex, where he took his PhD in American Studies. Dr. Horn presently serves as the Abby and George O'Neill Director of the John D. Rockefeller Library at Colonial Williamsburg. Among his many important academic appointments were his 1999 to 2002 position as the Saunders Director at the International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, during which time he was also a visiting professor at the Corcoran Department of History here at the University of Virginia. His list of publications covers four single-spaced pages. His talk today grows out of his 2005 book, A Land as God Made It, Jamestown and the Birth of America, about which Edmund S. Morgan and Marie Morgan said in the New York Review of Books that Horn's telling is, quote, the most objective of several modern versions of Captain John Smith's policies and campaigns in the early days of Jamestown, a story these leading historians tell us matters very much. Please welcome Jim Horn.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be back in Charlottesville, especially at such a lovely time of the year. And first, I would like to thank Gordon and Mary Beth for their interest in my work and encouragement, and also to George for inviting me to give this annual lecture this morning. And of course, it's a very pleasant surprise to be here in the House of Burgesses. We in Williamsburg, of course, have our own House of Burgesses, but given what I'm going to be talking about today, it's a reminder, I think, of the central point of my paper presentation today, which is how important Virginia is, not only in terms of its historical foundations, but also to us today. So that's really the theme that I want to discuss with you this morning, the importance of Jamestown, the importance of Virginia, and the importance of its legacies. And one of the curious things to me in going through the and perhaps that's not a very elegant way of putting it, but that's how it felt, going through the 2007 anniversary last year. One of the curious things to me was how poorly the history of Jamestown is understood by the majority of people in this country. It was a poll, a survey done a few years ago by the Virginia Tourism Corporation, and found only 7% of the national population understood that 1607 was the date of the founding of Jamestown. Less than a quarter could name Virginia as the first colony. Less than 1% knew the names of the three ships that brought the first settlers to Virginia. That compares to 43% that thought that the name of the first ship was the Mayflower, and 15% that cited the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria. So going into the commemoration in 2007, we knew we had a bit of work to do. I don't really want to criticise any recent films, but I'm not certain that The New World, Terrence Malick's story of early Virginia, did us much good either. Of course, for many people who know anything about early Virginia, it might be the Smith Pocahontas story. But this, of course, itself is very largely a fabrication. So it might be, as Alan Taylor, the historian Alan Taylor, commented at the end of last year, that as an origins myth, Smith's last-minute rescue by a beautiful Indian princess has somewhat greater appeal today than what he describes as Plymouth's Thanksgiving, which he mentions as a staid meal accompanied by prayer. But we'll get into a bit more about New England later on. But the problem is, I think, that the popular fiction of Smith's salvation and Pocahontas' conversion to English ways has served really only to distort and trivialise the meaning of these events and the larger history of which they were a part. So one of the key issues for me in writing about Jamestown's early history and in giving talks and interviews last year was to convey the complexity and the drama of the early history of Virginia, what took place 400 years ago, and also to answer a simple question: why does Jamestown matter? Or maybe even more basically, does it matter? Are there important lessons to be learned from those early years? and what, if any, have been the enduring legacies. This morning, then, I'm going to give you my sense of the significance of Jamestown and why I connect Jamestown to the birth of modern America. The subtitle of my book is deliberate. It might not be fashionable amongst scholars, but I'm going to defend it. Now, I think for the most part, it's fair to say that Jamestown's never had an especially good press. Within a few years of the founding of the settlement, tales were getting back to England already of cannibalism and starvation. Thousands of settlers, instead of finding a land of milk and honey, only found an early grave. Modern historians have described Jamestown as a chaotic and unstable place, fractured by dissension and war, devastated by disease, stigmatized by racism. During the first decade, the distinguished historian Edmund S. Morgan writes, the colonists made nearly every possible mistake and some that seem almost impossible. Jamestown was a fiasco, a shambles, and for a good 60 years after its founding, more closely resembled a collection of undisciplined work gangs than a stable colony, this is Morgan's words. The portrait of Jamestown that has come down to us, Karen Kupperman comments in a recent book, depicts greedy, grasping colonists and their arrogant backers in England. English ignorance and belligerence in their dealings with Powhatan peoples and the ruthless exploitation of poor white labourers and enslaved Angolans in their headlong pursuit of profit from tobacco. Jamestown, she says, is the creation story from hell. And on the face of it, if you just look at the facts, there might seem little reason to dispute that view. Within 8 months of landfall in May 1607, more than 60% of the original 104 adventurers who landed on Jamestown Island were dead. Of the approximately 1,800 settlers dispatched to Virginia over the next 9 years, only 350 remained when John Rolfe made his survey of the colony in 1616. And discounting returnees to England, at least three quarters of the colonists had therefore either perished or run away to the Indians. During the Great Migration of 1618 to 1623, several thousand more succumbed to disease or were killed in Indian attacks. For a decade and a half, I'm going to keep going here, for a decade and a half, the colony teetered on the brink of collapse and was a total financial loss to its sponsor, the Virginia Company of London. Hopes of converting the Powhatans to Anglicanism and Englishness perished in the great uprising of March 22, 1622, that left a quarter of the settlers dead in a single day. In the smoking ruins of settlements along the James River, the vision of a Protestant bulwark in North America that embraced Indian peoples as well as English colonists was lost forever. Virginia's population, Morgan says, down to the 1660s was almost exclusively male. There were few families. Life expectancy was lower than in other colonies and in England throughout the century. The effect of these imbalances, he says, on developing institutions made Jamestown a highly abnormal society. It was an aberration. So relegating Virginia to the status of an aberration, of course, opens the way to a seemingly more attractive alternative. Americans, it has been argued, prefer to think of Plymouth as our true foundations. The Plymouth Pilgrims, in our agreed-upon national story, are portrayed as the direct opposites of the Jamestown group. They were humble people who wanted only a place to worship God as they saw fit, who lived in friendship with one another and with neighbouring Indians. They occupied family farms and were content with self-sufficiency. These are the forebears we prefer to acknowledge. In this vein, Nathaniel Philbrick's recent bestseller, Mayflower, carries the subtitle, A Story of Courage, Community and War. And it's hard to imagine a title like that for a book on early Virginia. The blurb tells us that the crucial half century from 1620 to 1676 contained the seeds of what would come to define America, and that the book portrays the ultimate American story, whatever that is. In the opening chapter, Philbrick gives Jamestown short shrift, recounting in a few brief sentences that Jamestown could hardly be counted a success before moving on to the main themes of his plot. In this version of the founding of English America, Virginia is simply ignored. Now, I'm not going to go through and answer these various points one by one. There's not the time. This isn't the place to do it. But it seems to me that the basic conclusion is this. Jamestown, in contrast to New England, is a foundational story we'd rather forget. It's a false start, only worth remembering as an antitype or an exercise in failure. This failure, as Morgan argues, was not confined only to the opening years, but disfigured Virginia society for the entire century. While New England is normative, most closely resembling English society, Virginia was a parody of the mother country. Now, if Virginia's significance can be judged only in terms of being less or more like New England, or for that matter, 17th century English society, then I guess I would concede the argument. But that clearly is not the measure I would apply. So first, let's consider the implications of Jamestown, the very fact of Jamestown's survival against a rather broader backdrop. 16th and early 17th century North America was littered with failed colonies. The Spanish in Florida, the French at Fort Caroline and Port Royal, the English at Baffin Island, Roanoke and Sagadahoc in Maine. Few colonies lasted more than a year. The challenge of novel environmental conditions, of harsh winters, of disease, of hostile Indians and other Europeans, of providing sufficient provisions for hungry settlers, and the sheer cost of ventures overwhelmed most efforts. The survival of Jamestown, as a number of historians have commented, was something of a miracle, and the consequences, both good and bad, have been far-reaching. In the first place, the presence of Jamestown anchored the Chesapeake region and areas farther north for the English. I'm speaking in Eurocentric terms here, of course. The Virginia Company took possession of Virginia in the name of James I and England and was not overly concerned about property rights of local peoples. Virginia, as far as the company was concerned, was, quote, English ground. And the majority and the major threat to the colonists' survival came not from the Powhatans, but from the Spanish. The expansion of English settlement in Virginia gave the English a vital foothold on the mainland and a base from which to strike against other European powers, such as in 1613, when Captain Samuel Argall was dispatched from Jamestown to destroy several small French settlements in Maine and Nova Scotia. The English weren't, of course, able to exclude other Europeans from North America in this period. The Spanish were already in Florida and the French in Canada. But by the 1660s, with the growth of England's mercantile marine and with the expulsion of the Dutch from New Netherland, New York, much of the eastern seaboard would come under their control. I want to just invite you into a little bit of counterfactual history for a moment. What if Jamestown had collapsed in 1607 or 8 or 1610, as seemed quite likely? It seems to me that it may have been the case that other European nations, such as the Spanish, French or Dutch, could well have moved in to the mid-Atlantic region that could have discouraged the establishment of English settlements farther north in New England. Instead of settling at Plymouth, the Pilgrims might have ended up elsewhere, perhaps in Guyana, an alternative suggested at the time. And Massachusetts settlers might have joined other Puritan groups, moving to Providence Island or the islands in the West Indies. It's even possible, it seems to me, that the English might have abandoned any efforts to colonise the mainland and focused instead on the West Indies, on the Caribbean. Can't prove any of this, but the point is a simple one. The early history of colonisation, of English colonisation, is not, if you like, a series of completely isolated and independent events. The founding of Jamestown and the success, in terms of survival at least, of Virginia had consequences for the founding of other English colonies on the Atlantic and North American Atlantic seaboard. Let me just say something else very briefly about another measure, if you like, of significance or success. Commercial expansion. Commercial expansion is at the heart not only of Virginia's history, but of the history of the early English Empire in America and elsewhere. For early modern Europeans, the New World was a place where riches could be found and fortunes could be made. The vast majority of settlers went to America to make money, or at least to find a comfortable subsistence. They did not go, the vast majority did not go for religious reasons. Jamestown then was founded on the fundamental principles of English colonial policy devised in the late 16th century. And that underpinned colonial trade for the next two centuries. England's empire was from the very beginning an empire of goods, and in early Virginia, the first of the great staples of colonial trade was discovered in the form of tobacco. Shifting consumer patterns across Europe, England and Europe over the course of the 17th century maintained an enormous increase in demand. And you could say the same of the 18th century with the development of the taking of snuff. My point then is that the importance of Virginia, the reason why it becomes the most populous and wealthy of the mainland colonies, is based on tobacco. You sometimes see the whole argument, the whole issue of plantation agriculture and tobacco framed in the context of slavery, which of course is closely connected in the 18th century, not so much in the 17th century. But there is another way of looking at this, which is thinking about the importance of the American colonies to the English commercial empire. The epicenter of the English commercial empire in America in the 16th, and it's true of the in the 17th, and it's true of the 18th century as well, is the West Indies for sugar and tobacco in the Chesapeake region. It's the expansion, the importance of tobacco that leads to several other important developments in early Virginia. There's a direct link to the development of private property, the move away from a company-sponsored economy to private enterprise and private property, the establishment of private property in Virginia, the first English colony where the precepts of private property are established. And if you're going to protect the individual's right to property, you've got to have some kind of local jurisdiction to do that, and that's the House of Burgesses or the General Assembly. That, it seems to me, the principal reason for the founding of the first General Assembly in 1619. So there's, again, a direct connection between the commerce, private property, and the form of government. Now, the colonising impulse of the English and other European powers unleashed powerful, destructive forces. Whatever the English may have thought about Virginia being English ground in America, there were clearly other forces, other peoples who would have disputed that. 15,000 Algonquian Indians lived in the Tidewater, perhaps as many again in the Piedmont at the time of the English arrival. The fractured and tortured relationships between the English and the Indian peoples are, of course, a central feature of the early history of Jamestown. I would only say that the English went to Virginia, certainly with all the Anglo-centric views or Eurocentric views, in seeing the Indian peoples, the Powhatans, as somehow culturally inferior. But they also went with a desire, as wrong-headed as we now know it to be, to convert, to Christianize Indian peoples. And that's when I was referring to the Protestant bulwark. We can lose sight of this, that Virginia is founded at a time when the major threat to England and Protestant powers in Europe is Spain. Spain is the superpower of the early 17th century, and there is a very important presence of Catholic Spain, of course, in America. So Virginia would be the beginnings, the creation, the starting point for a Protestant nation in North America. And that nation did not exclude Indian peoples initially. It did after 1622, but not before that. Okay, I'm going to really come to my central point, and that is this. When we think of the legacies, and I won't have time here to talk about the legacy and the issue of slavery, but perhaps we can get into that during the question time. When we think of the legacies, what really comes down to us in thinking about Jamestown? For the planners of the commemoration, there were four major themes. There was exploration, there was diversity, there was representative government, and there was free enterprise. It was all pretty clear-cut. And it had to be simplified to get this message across, to get a message across to the general public. But amongst scholars, there's very little agreement about the legacy of Jamestown. You've heard me talk about some of the, what I'd say is negative opinions, negative discourse. But even leaving that aside, the other major argument that comes through is that there cannot be any one single point of origin, neither Jamestown nor New England, that American society emerges from multiple points of origin. Indian peoples, the Spanish, the Dutch, the Swedes, the Finns, and so on and so forth. Now, I think in terms of cultural diversity, that point is indisputable. You can read it, for example. This point is made by Alan Taylor in his piece in The New Republic of September 2007. In terms of cultural diversity, it's indisputable. But what of the founding of the United States? What of that? And it seems to me that here that argument does not carry quite as much weight. Because it seems to me that what is crucial with regards to the founding of the United States is the presence of English America, 17th century, British America in the 18th century. That it was, if you like, the transference of English laws, of English institutions, of English constitutionalism that had a profound effect on the emergence of the early United States. It's why, very simply, we speak English. Well, that's our first language. It's why we're a Protestant country for the most part, even though there are diverse religions. And it's why our legal code and, as I say, our political institutions still carry the imprint of earlier British institutions. I'm not trying to set out here an English version of Manifest Destiny, but I think it's, and it would be, it wouldn't really be appropriate for me to do that. But it does seem to me indisputable that the emergence of the United States has the imprint, at least, is profoundly influenced by the presence of the British colonies. My final point, George, is that I think that as a founding story, Jamestown is important not only because it can teach us a lot about some of the successes, the survival, the determination of colonists in this period. Not only because Jamestown was the first successful English colony, purely actually, I think, because it survived, but also because of the introduction of certain basic institutions that were important for the development of English America in the 17th century. All successful English colonies after followed, if you like, in the wake of Jamestown. But it's also a foundational story that's warts and all. It's got elements within it. Here we're coming to the pattern of violence that was established at Jamestown with respect to Indian peoples, the exploitation of Africans and African Americans. It's got aspects of this story to an origin story that we, I think, it's incumbent upon us to get to grips with. I think that's why it's an important story. Thank you.
Let me invite those who have questions to move to the back of the room, and Dr. Lopez-Gattardi will have a microphone there that will enable your questions to be heard loud and clear, both by others in this room and those in the vast worldwide television audience that watches the program a couple of weeks after we have it live here. I'd like to, while people are moving to the back of the room, don't be bashful, don't be shy. Go ahead and get up and ask a question. But while you're moving to the back of the room, Dr. Horn, I'd like to ask sort of an opening question, and that is, I understand your argument, I think, about the legacies of England in America that started in Jamestown or early colonial Virginia, but slavery is peculiarly un-English. How did the English settlers permit this most un-English practice to not only creep in, but to take hold and to flower?
I think it's true. It's certainly true that in terms of numbers, English society never develops much in the way of slavery. There may have been at most 10,000 enslaved Africans in England, even as late as the 18th century. But you can't talk about a slave society. I think the issue is attitudes, and it's pretty clear that English merchants, that those involved in colonizing projects, have picked up on the Spanish model. The Spanish are very, very important in terms of English colonization. They're both the threat, but also the model. The English go to America hoping to replicate what the Spanish had achieved, in their view, in South America and Middle America and in the islands. So already by the late 16th century, perhaps even earlier than that, mid-16th century, English merchants are trading to the west coast of Africa, and you can begin to see the kind of racial stereotypes developing as early as that, and certainly in early Virginia. So the numbers of enslaved Africans in early Virginia are, again, relatively small, no more than 1,000 or so by 1660. That compares to 33,000 in the West Indies. But the racial stereotypes had already been long established.
First, I want to say how much I enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
In the book, it seemed like every few months, the colonists were just on the brink of starvation, and it happened year after year after year. And yet the Indians were able to survive. There was a river teeming with fish. Were they afraid to follow what the Indians were doing? Did they not have the organization to farm? What caused this continual situation with starvation in the early days?
Thank you. It seems puzzling on the face of it, because many of the early English descriptions describe an Eden, a land of abundance, superabundance, in fact. So, what was happening? And I think the way to picture it, early on at least, is that the English were there primarily to find, following the Spanish model, gold and silver mines in the interior, a passage to the South Sea. They were looking to make the most of natural produce, timber. Fish would be sent back to England if they could catch them. They had a bit of a problem in doing that oftentimes. So they would take the food, being self-sufficient, was not initially a priority, because they would trade with the Indians for food and get supplies from England. It became a priority during the First Anglo-Powhatan War, because then, of course, the Powhatans were reluctant to trade, but by that time the English got into what they called food fights and would simply take the corn from the Indians. The first evidence of the English trying to follow Indian practice in growing corn, you can see it in around about summer of 1608, that they're trying to do it.
Yes, a number of years ago, the PBS show, The Secrets of the Dead, advanced the thesis that the high mortality at the beginning of Jamestown may have been the result of deliberate poisoning by a Spanish agent. I wonder if you could comment on that.
I saw a piece, actually, I think it was in Time, in the Time magazine of last year, that dealt with Jamestown, that commented on arsenic in the well. And it's linked, actually, the whole story, and you might recall this, the story is linked to the presence of Spanish spies in Jamestown. Now, that part of it is true. There clearly was very good intelligence coming out of Jamestown that was being filtered through to the Spanish. My good colleague down at Jamestown, Bill Kelso, who knows more about wells, and particularly a well from 1608 than I will ever know, or I might add, probably would want to know. I don't think he's found too much evidence of the well being poisoned.
In America, it's easy to see Jamestown in contrast to the Puritans in New England. Jamestown, we see, is totally this maybe a very secular, profit-seeking organization. But your discussion of the Great Uprising in 22, the inclusion initially of Indians into this Protestant bulwark kind of speaks differently to that. Do you want to kind of flesh out, was the role of religion something that grew, declined with time?
Thank you. Yeah, it's a really important issue. And I like, when I was teaching here and elsewhere, I always like to say, well, the first Puritans actually came to Virginia. In fact, you could talk about Bermuda as well, because there were Puritans on Bermuda in 1609 with the wreck of the Sea Venture. But there were certainly Puritans in Virginia long before New England. So that Puritan diaspora that we tend to see really as Puritanism in New England is a false dichotomy. Like most of the counterpointing between New England and Virginia, it's rather off the mark. But to speak directly to your point, reimagining, the recreation of Virginia in 1609, and this is really the effort of Sir Thomas Smith, the great London plutocrat, and the soldiers who went to Virginia in 1609, Sir Thomas Gates, and then later Sir Thomas Dale, lots of Thomases here. They have a vision which is to reform Virginia and to win the Indians to Englishness through converting them to Christianity. They actually talk about liberating Indian peoples, from their priests and kings. There was, in other words, the Indians, and this is a really important point, the Indians were capable, the Powhatans were capable of being redeemed. The story of Pocahontas, therefore, as I write in my book, is a story of redemption. They were not, if you like, beyond the pale. They could be brought into a Christian polity, and that was the effort. And there were a whole number of sermons and so on that really lay this out. And it's linked to a providential view of England as a bulwark, a Protestant bulwark. This little island, as Thomas Cooper describes in 1618, this little island is a place, he's talking about England, it is a place where Protestants can come together to resist the Catholic Spain, the might of Catholic Spain. And Virginia was an extension of this war between the Protestants and the Catholics that erupted in 1618 with the 30 Years' War. So what I like to do is try and frame Virginia in this broader conflict and see Virginia as part of that greater conflict between Catholics and Protestants that's going on in Europe, as it was. That's how the English described it as at the time. And the story, of course, of Pocahontas, the importance of Pocahontas, revolves around the fact that she proved that Indian peoples were capable of redemption, could become Christian, and could become English. At least that's what the English thought. It wasn't quite like that, but that's what they thought. So 1622 is a break point as far as the English are concerned. It's a very important part of Virginia's early history, though.
You said there were very few women, English women, in Jamestown at the beginning. When did the first English women settlers come, and then how did the proportion to the total Jamestown population change in the early years?
Well, first two women, there are only two of them, but they arrived in October of 1608. And they were followed, and we don't know the numbers, actually. So I can't speculate on precise numbers, but I think you could say that maybe there were maybe a couple of dozen that followed over the next 5 or 6 years. Could have been a few more, I don't know. The larger numbers of women begin to come into the colony from around about 1618, 1619, and that's a deliberate policy on the part of the Virginia Company, who are trying to encourage more single women to go to Virginia to create families. So one aspect of survival that I didn't touch upon, it's the most fundamental in a way, was the success of the Virginia Company to attract women, to persuade women to go to Virginia, because, of course, without the women, there could have been no development of family life or community life. The ratios in the early years were 6 to 1, 6 males for every woman. Later in the century, probably 3 to 1. But Morgan really overstates the case in talking about Virginia society in the 1660s and 70s as predominantly or almost exclusively male. That's overstating it. There were families were established and local communities were established in Virginia even before Plymouth. And you can see the growth of these small local communities, both on Jamestown Island, up towards the Curls near Richmond. By 1614 or so, they're already there. So women play a very, very important part in the survival of the colony.
South America has extraordinary natural wealth and resources, maybe even more than North America. And you have pointed out some of the reasons why we have turned out as we have, English law and some of the other signs of stability. I also wonder whether George Washington and the founding brothers or fathers, whatever term we want to use, haven't had an extremely important role in turning out who we are here today.
Well, absolutely. And I always point to Thomas Jefferson's mother being English. Of course, she was, as you all know, from the parish of Shadwell in London, near where I was born, as a matter of fact. I would absolutely agree with you. And again, I want to emphasize here that I'm not necessarily trying to say that it's better that we turned out to be English rather than Spanish or Dutch. I'm just saying that in terms of who we are, in terms of how we evolved, in terms of the influences upon the likes of Jefferson, George Mason, Washington and others, Patrick Henry, you can't explain that flowering of ideas in the 1760s and 1770s that articulated, firstly, the resistance, the premise of the resistance to Britain, and then the premise for a self-governing republic in the United States. I don't know if you can explain that without having a thorough understanding, as Jefferson did and many of the founders did, of English constitutionalism, itself deemed the most advanced in the world, despite its faults, if you like, in the 18th century. Not to say that the likes of Jefferson and so on didn't read the French, or certainly the classics had an enormous influence on these men. But if you're looking for direct influences, I would say it's Commonwealth thinking, mid-17th century, radical Whiggery in the 18th century that has an enormous influence on the language and the development of English thinking, of American thinking, I should say, in the late 18th century.
We're presently in the throes of now it's become a national, worldwide problem of a venture that apparently didn't have a plan. It's very easy to get into it, but almost impossible to get out of it. We have, my wife and I have done a lot of studying on Jamestown, have been there several times recently, and one of the questions has become, what kind of a plan did the Virginia Company have? They obviously didn't have, had sent out people to scout around before and come up with ideas, but hopefully they just didn't put 100 people in 3 boats and send them over there and said, do your thing.
Right, and thank you for the question. And again, in terms of the idea that Jamestown was a shambles, you sometimes see that applied to the Virginia Company, that the Virginia Company didn't know what it was doing. In fact, it knew very well what it was doing. The expedition was carefully planned. These expeditions cost, in modern terms, hundreds of thousands of pounds to mount. They were extremely expensive, so you had to know what you were doing. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the financial backing to do it. They drew upon the experience of the English at Roanoke, maybe not so happy experience at Roanoke, and they scouted out the region. The Chesapeake, Virginia, was to be the place where the English would settle all the way from the mid-1580s. When the English decided that the Outer Banks wasn't going to be suitable, they chose the Chesapeake. So it was very careful planning. You can see it in, if you turn to, for example, the instructions of November or December 1606, you can see there very carefully what the Virginia Company wanted the president and council of Virginia to do. And you see it in the instructions of the governors subsequently, very carefully laid out. So things didn't go according to plan, of course, but they certainly had planned the expedition very, very carefully.
Thinking about Jamestown as a place on the James River, a geographical spot, I think back in the 1950s, going to Jamestown and seeing a very pretty little park by the riverside, a nice place to contemplate history if one was so inclined. And I think about Jamestown now with a very much a commercialized tourist attraction with museums and ships and reconstructions and so forth. And then I think about your statistics that show that people apparently have very little appreciation generally of the importance of Jamestown. And I wonder, is there any time series or will there be any that will show any improvement as we commercialize and apply resources to Jamestown? Will the historical appreciation improve?
Well, time will tell, I think. let me just give you my thoughts on the commemoration and what was achieved. And I should just say, I think the Jamestown Island continues to be a really lovely spot, partly because the Park Service, as you probably know, has not really done too much work down there since the 50s. There's been some, but not a great deal. So it's still a very peaceful and restful place to go, even with all the activity around Bill's site, Bill Kelso's site, and the Archaearium. A word that I have no idea what it means, and I'm not certain anyone else does. Bill tells me he knows, but I'm not certain. I would say that there was, during 2007, particularly around this time last year, April and May, an enormous number of interviews, both in the national press, but radio and TV, a number of programs, great interest in the Queen's visit, interest in President Bush's visit too. And there were what I would say were some very good sound bites, and the news, you know, you'd flash up the ships and so on, or the fort, or Bill Kelso and so on. But it kind of came and went. That was my impression. It was also my impression that the real substance of interest tended to be mainly regional. The whole effort in the commemoration was to talk about America's 400th anniversary, to try and make the case that there is a broad, that the story of Jamestown is not just Virginia's, it's an American story, and behooves us to understand it, I suppose. But I'm not certain how much success, to be honest, those of us involved in the commemoration had in making the case. I have a vivid memory of going up the coast with the Godspeed sail, and when we stopped at Alexandria or in Baltimore, even in New York, there was quite a lot of interest. But I can tell you, it was very, very quiet in Boston, very quiet. And we were giving it away. You didn't have to pay to get in. We were begging people to come and see our ship and the activities there. It was very quiet. And I don't have a great stake in this. I live in Virginia. I teach Virginia history and so on. As you've already gathered, I'm not Virginian and I'm not from New England. But it puzzles me, frankly, that our origins is seen in terms of these segmented or separated or isolated origins, that New Englanders really are very much interested only in their history. New Yorkers would be the 400th of the discovery of the Hudson next year, and so on, that maybe out west we're talking about Santa Fe, or we're talking about San Augustine in 1565. Now, I understand that the multiple points of origin approach, but in terms of the United States, in terms of the heritage I've been talking about, the survival of English America, I think, is significant. So it may be simply it's unfashionable to elevate one region over another, New Englanders really just can't stomach Virginians going on about their own importance. Maybe there's something to that. But nevertheless, it did. The regionalism, the regional lens in which we look at our national history, it really did strike me during the event, and continues to strike me, actually. You, and now myself, living in America, can date to the day the origins of English America. You say April 29th, when the ships come into the Chesapeake Bay, or May 13th, when they're anchored off Jamestown Island. The English would kill to have that kind of specificity. When do we date the origins of the English people? I mean, we're all over the place. So it just strikes me as peculiar that we can't somehow agree on this. But More of that later. Thank you.
Thank you for a very enlightening talk. You mentioned a little bit about slavery. I want to touch on that a little bit. England forbade slavery long before it was stopped here in the colonies. Could you address the reason for that as to why, even though while England had control of the colonies, they did not stop the slaveries here?
I think that it's partly a matter of timing. Whilst we were celebrating or commemorating the 400th of Jamestown in Britain, the commemoration was all about the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. And I think when you're looking at the 1760s or 1770s, the English government had no real desire to prohibit the slave trade. There's too much money in it. The British are the greatest carriers of transporters of Africans throughout the 18th century. They transported forcibly more Africans than all the other Europeans put together in the 18th century. That's the legacy, if you like, of the British slave trade. Abolitionism really is only getting underway in Britain in the 1770s and 1780s. So there was no political urgency to ban the slave trade and slavery in the colonies at that time. The question is, or might be, so why does it take the descendants of those of English people or British people and other peoples, why does it take them so long? And I think Virginia is a good case as to why slavery persists in the new republic. And I suppose this is, as Morgan points out, the central paradox, and again has enormous implications for modern society. And I go back to Thomas Jefferson and thinking of his thinking in the Notes on the State of Virginia, at his efforts to bring about the abolition of the slave trade and his efforts to, in his second draft constitution for Virginia, to propose gradual abolition. But it seemed that property trumped, if you like, the morality. Just a very simplistic way of putting it, maybe, but I think that's what it came down to. Slavery was just so embedded in the economy and in the psyche, almost, of Virginia and other colonies, that it was very, very difficult for even someone of his stature to really find a solution to it. The turning point for me was 1832. I think during those debates in the General Assembly in 1832, that was probably the tipping point, and the fact that there could be no resolution that really doomed the issue of abolition for another 30 years or so.
Dr. James Horn will be signing copies of A Land as God Made It, Jamestown and the Birth of America, outside the forum room after we leave. I'd particularly like to thank again Mary Beth and Gordon Smith for enabling this terrific forum, and thanks very much to Jim Horn for deepening and enriching our understanding of the legacies of Jamestown.